We're learning today Perek Yutes of the Gvuras Hashem, and progressing through the story of Moshe Rabbeinu's emergence from the house of Paro as a leader for the Jewish people. And we learn here about Moshe Rabbeinu going out the second day and seeing Shnei Anoshim Ivrim Nitzim, thank you, seeing two Jewish men fighting. And the Gemara tells us, Rashi brings, that these two Anoshim Ivrim were Dosan Vaviram. And Dosan Vaviram stood as chronic antagonists to Moshe Rabbeinu. Heim she'amru davar zeh, they said this, Nisam Chalishtar v'shefet aleinu, Heim she'siru min amon, they are the ones who left over from the mon, Heim she'amru nitna reish, they are the ones who said, let us appoint a leader and go back to Mitzrayim. So in other words, in these various stories which stood as challenges to Moshe Rabbeinu, whether here, whether by the Mon, whether by the Meraglim, of course, as we know, the Pasuk is explicit that Dothan and Aviram were also major antagonists in the story of Korach, which was a direct challenge to Moshe Rabbeinu. So this was them. This was they and their role. Dikduku Chazal b'Medrash Hazeh. So the Maral explains, what's this idea that these two people are Dosan v'Aviram? Why couldn't it just be two Jewish men who were fighting, got into a fight, and didn't like Moshe Rabbeinu mixing in? What's the idea that it's the same Dosan v'Aviram who are here, who are there, who are everywhere, whenever it comes to the antagonism to Moshe Rabbeinu? The Maral explains that what we're reading here is big stuff. What we're reading here is the process that leads to the Geula. What do you mean? This is the process of getting Moshe Rabbeinu in trouble. But of course, what happens from this is that Moshe Rabbeinu goes to Midian. And Moshe Rabbeinu's travel to Midian is an important part of the process of Moshe Rabbeinu developing into the leader of the Jewish people. And once he goes out to his brothers, he has to again leave and go to Midian, and whatever else is involved in that. So Moshe Rabbeinu has to go to Midian, and this is a critical piece of that story. Says the Maral, first and foremost, that that's not something which comes from Mikra, from chance. Moshe Rabbeinu happened to lock horns with these two guys, and that led to him going. Something which is so essential to the flow of the story comes with something that is essential to the story, comes with something that is fundamental to the story. And therefore, it's not possible, says the Gemara, that says Chazal, that this was just two guys, but that these were people who stood as the classic antagonists of Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's element number one of this argument, and element two of this argument. So what does it mean that it's Be'etzem? What does it mean that it's Dosan Aviram? And Dosan Aviram standing as the classic antagonist to them. So he says, you know, and he brings a Medrash Tehillim that Dosan and Aviram, when the Jewish people were struggling and fighting, they wanted to appoint Dosan in place of Moshe Rabbeinu and Aviram in place of Aaron HaKoyen. Right? So Tiftach Eretz v'Tivla Dosan v'Tchatzal Adas Aviram, that's what the Pasuk says, that it was when in saying in the Reish v'Nashuva Mitzrayim, we'll appoint leaders and go back to Mitzrayim, this was these were Dosan and Aviram. And they stood as antagonists personally to Moshe and to Aaron. And so I want to again try to explain this a little bit. There's an aspect here of Zeh Le'umas Zeh, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu creates opposites, opposing forces between the good and the bad. Zeh Le'umas Zeh Osoha Elohim. I want to try to illustrate it by looking, for example, at Avram Avinu. Avram Avinu was also a leader who emerged, a father and leader who emerged for the Bnei Yisrael. Avram Avinu had a lot of antagonism which he faced in his life. What do I mean? Where did he face antagonism? Well, what's the first story that we know of the antagonism that Avram Avinu faced? Was the Kivshon Ha'esh, was where they wanted to throw him into the fiery furnace. You could say the antagonist to some degree was his father, but his father was a subject of Nimrod, and in fighting against Avram Avinu, all he did was give him over to Nimrod. He saw what Avram Avinu was doing was a rebellion against the culture and community that he lived in, which Terach went along with, and when his son was acting out and rebelling and doing what he did, so he said, "You're going against the king, I'm going to give you over to the king." So it ended up being a confrontation between Avraham and Nimrod. That's what happens. Okay. The Avraham Avinu goes on to Mitzrayim. And even Mitzrayim, Chazal, to some degree associate Pare Melech Mitzrayim, also to some degree with Nimrod and his personality. For example, we find that Eliezer, who came with him from there. I'm sorry. I'm not going to be able to draw the line. I'm not remembering clearly, but there's some association there. But in any case, after Avraham Avinu has his thing with Paro, so let's leave Paro alone for a minute, because I'm just again not recalling precisely the relationship. But the Avraham Avinu has the battle against the four kings, and the battle against the four kings is understood by Chazal that even though it seems from one layer of the pasuk to be a empire grab that happened to include Lot, who lived in the five towns that were opposed to the four kings. However, Chazal see that there were actually two things that were going on, like is true in many world conflicts, or I would say in all world conflicts in a certain sense, that which is that on one level it was their regional battle for, you know, for power, for the empire, and there was also the battle of the spirit, the battle against Avram. And Chazal are medayik this in a certain sense from the fact that when it lists the four kings, sometimes it starts with Kedar la'Omer Melech Elam, who was the owner, who was the, you know, the dominant financial or whatever it is empire power. And sometimes it starts by Hibime Amraphel Melech Shinar. Amraphel is associated with Nimrod. Amraphel is Omar Pol leKivshon HaEsh. He said, go fall into, drop into the Kivshon HaEsh, into the fiery furnace. And Chazal see that the battle takes place on these two tracks. The battle takes place on the global track of conquest, and on the specific track of trying to get Lot, who's the heir apparent of Avram Avinu, who's going to spread the teachings of Avram Avinu. That's the way it should go. So Nimrod is again there, standing there as the antagonist of Avram Avinu in this battle, and it's because he does it. And Chazal go back a step and see it back by the Dar HaFloga. Right, the Dar HaFloga was, you know, the tower of Bavel was there as well. You know, his work that he went and he brought the whole world to be more, to rebel against HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that stood in opposition to Avram Avinu, who was the Echad, who stood aside and apart from that entire generation. So there's a great man named Avram, and that great man has a counterpart, has an antagonist who stands against him, and that antagonist was Nimrod. And so he pops up over and over again in the story. He's the hero, he's the anti-hero. Moshe and Aaron had the same thing, and the anti-heroes to Moshe and to Aaron were Dothan to Moshe and Aviram to Aaron. They each had their place, and they each stood again in their own way to oppose them as personalities that stood for or that represent the opposite. So they had a strength to contrast to go against the two of them. And so this story as well, which emerges with Moshe Rabbeinu being seeing the Shnei Anashim Ivrim Nitzim, it's not enough that it just happens to be such a story, but it's the emergence of the counterforce to Moshe and Aaron here at this point in time. Okay, so two nekudos. Let's summarize what the Maral is identifying here in this paragraph. Two nekudos, two points. First of all, something which is so essential to the story doesn't happen from a little anecdote, a little incident that happened to be there across the way. It should be part of something consistent, something which is not b'mikra, something which is not a chance, a happening, but something which is much more real and essential. And second layer of that is that when you have someone like Moshe and someone like Aaron, you have these two great people who will stand to lead the Jewish people, so it stands to reason, and it's there that there would be two who would stand in opposition. When you have something so singular, in the words of the Maral, just as there were these two Shleime Hayetzira, perfect creations that had none like them, kach nimtza shnayim kineg them, so too they would be found two who would oppose them, hara l'umas hatayv, the bad opposite the good, ze l'umas ze asa ha'elokim. We know that when it comes to prophecy, Moshe Rabbeinu had a counterpart. What was he? It was Bilam, right? In the power of prophecy, Moshe Rabbeinu had his, like, come be Israel, aval ba'uma Yisraelam come. Amongst the Jewish people, there was no one like Moshe Rabbeinu, but there would be a counterpart regarding the Uma Yisraelam. Dasan and Aviram do not seem ever to challenge the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, but they challenge the leadership of Moshe Rabbeinu. Misam chalisar v'shayvet aleinu. Consistently, in that sense. I mean, yes, by the mud, they were doing their thing about trying to collect it on Shabbos or whatever, but not as substitutions for that. But you have to have this kind of a thing, of an opposite force that rises against the great force which represents Moshe Rabbeinu. And so that's the way it works. And Maral goes over this a few paragraphs later on the paragraph Ayishma Paro, which is on the next page on the bottom, when Rashi comments there, Paro heard about what happened because Dasan va'aviram stood and hilshinu olav. So he says again the same idea, that Paro wouldn't just stam have heard, but he would have heard from Dasan va'aviram, who would be the chronic thorns in the side of Moshe Rabbeinu, the constant opposition to Moshe and Aaron. He says, don't think that they were the only ones who were opposed to Moshe Rabbeinu, but they were the ones who were the primary, the Shnayim, Keneged Shnayim, the two opposite the two. So that's one point which the Maral teaches here. The Maral goes on.
Does Chazal ever discuss what Dasan and Aviram were fighting about? Does it matter at all?
I don't recall Chazal speaking about what they were fighting about. I'm sure there is something, I just don't recall. Rashi doesn't bring it, the Maral here isn't discussing it.
Yeah, something to do with the fact that it was Dasan that. I don't remember exactly. Somebody says, I'll just say that it was Dasan who Moshe did the day before. And they were fighting something about that, but I don't remember exactly what it was. But it was more than that. But okay. It's interesting, the Maral says, it almost seems counterintuitive because we do find that he went to Midian. I don't know, it's hard to see Midian as being formative to Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, it's like almost like his exile. So yes, it happened to be that by being in Midian, so that's how the story did play out. But it's difficult to see that it had to play out that way. You would almost see it exactly the opposite as saying, like, had Moshe Rabbeinu stayed in Mitzrayim, he would have been there. The Gaulus could have come 40 years earlier or something like that. So by Dasan Aviram, by sending him away, by fighting and then by sending him away, they were antagonizing him and sending him away. It almost seemed to be that way.
No. Mirza Hashem, we'll see more about Midian, but no, it's not. Moshe Rabbeinu had to leave Mitzrayim. Once Moshe Rabbeinu went out to his brethren, so then this became a necessary step. That Moshe Rabbeinu had to again be removed from the situation, and was not yet right now a time, was not yet available. Moshe Rabbeinu was going out there because of his anxiousness to redeem the Jewish people, because of his readiness to redeem the Jewish people, but it would have to be postponed, and he would have to go through a period, the period which he would have in Midian. So that's the way he's viewing it. Mirz Hashem, we'll try to learn about it more. The next step was that, so Moshe Rabbeinu confronts these two, and he says to the Rasha, Lama Sakareyecha, why will you hit your brother? And the Gemara Chazal Darshan, that it doesn't say why did you hit your brother, but it says why will you hit your brother? And that tells you that he's called a Rasha just by Haramas Yad, just by raising his hand, by winding up to hit him, that's enough to call him a Rasha. And the Maral says, he says, Ki Haramas Yad hu ascholas hayetziyah l'harshiyah. The raising of the hand is the beginning of the evil act. And once the person has embarked on the evil act of being Rala Briyas, he's already called the Rasha. He says if he goes walking down the street, you know, towards the saloon, you know, to knock him out, that's not called, he's not called a Rasha for that, because he could walk down the street and decide to go to his ATM, or he could walk down the street and walk into the saloon and order a Coke. Even if he were something else, he may not even be called a Russian, right? But there's nothing which is inherent in the act that says that necessarily he's going to evil. And as long as there's ambiguity to it, we're not going to call him on the path of evil. But Haramas Yad, but when he raises his hand against the other person, there's no ambiguity anymore. He hasn't inflicted the harm yet, but he has taken a step towards inflicting the harm. And once he's taken the step towards inflicting the harm, even though it's still sake, even though it's still something in the future for the harm to happen, we can already call him the Russia. We can already call him the Russia. And, you know, Chazal, it's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that speaks about this thing that, you know, taking steps towards an Avera, where the actions again are unambiguously negative, so then that's already, one can already deem the person, unfortunately, to be the Russia. It's not a thought, it's not an action which is ambiguous, it's not a plan, but it's already taking steps towards the Avera. You know, it's like, at what time does the FBI sting operation end? You know, how many, you don't wait for the person to blow up the building, right? But certain steps, you know, the person's still just doing something which is ambiguous. Maybe he has 3 truckloads of fertilizer because he's changing and becoming a farmer. But you don't know. You have to see at a certain point where now it's unambiguous. Right? So of course we're not going to compare what it takes to have evidence for criminality to this, but there has to be actions which are clearly actions that are have no meaning other than for the negative. And once a person's done an action which has no meaning other than for the negative, even before the harm is actually inflicted, that's when Chazal already deemed that person to be the Rasha.
Is that the case even if he doesn't hit him, but the fact that he raised his hand and had that,
that's the point of the Gemara. The Gemara says, he's saying Rasha Lama Sakareyecha. Now maybe the fellow was just threatening him and he had no intention of hitting him. You know, that could be a fair question. He has no intention of hitting him.
He's
just trying to
scare him.
Once he starts doing an action to inflict harm on another person, even if he hasn't actually inflicted the harm, he's already able to be called a Russia for that action alone. Yeah.
Is this a further madriga than just having a mashava?
It seems, because the Gemara says that by tzaddikim machshava, machshava roi, and Hakadosh Baruch Hu, not just by tzaddikim, excuse me, but by Israel, machshava roi, and Hakadosh Baruch Hu mitzafel lemaisa. A bad thought, Hakadosh Baruch Hu doesn't say it's as if he did it. Here, it's because he's already started to do an action that heads him in that direction. Okay. Now, one of the points which the Maral makes here in this perek, and this one is the one which is perhaps of deepest and broadest significance, and it echoes a little bit, it echoes not a little bit, but it echoes more than a little bit, something which we spoke about a little bit in last week's perek, in perek Yud Ches. Vayomer Moshe, and Moshe says, Achein noida hadavor. Achein, what does that mean? Indeed, or alas, noida hadavor, the matter is known. Our fight from yesterday is now known. And that simple reading, of course, of that, the simple reading of that, of course, is that Moshe Rabbeinu says, the fact that I killed an Egyptian, which will win me no brownie points. Moshe Rabbeinu tried to do that. He looked here and he looked there and he saw that there was nobody, so he did it. And then Vayitmeneu Bachel, he hid him in the sand, he hid his victim in the sand. Moshe Rabbeinu tried to do it discreetly and to bury the evidence, but now it's known. And he says, uh-oh, it's known. And I'm going to get in trouble, which he, of course, did get in trouble. Paro heard, and Moshe Rabbeinu was a wanted man. However, Chazal read into Achein Noida Hadavar something else. And they say, as Rashi quotes, and the Maral here brings it to the Medrash, Rav Yudah Bar Sholem B'Shem Rav Chanina Agadol Rav Bissein B'Shem Rav Alexani Amru Hayomayshem Ahar B'Libay V'Omar Malchotu Yisrael She'ishtavdu Eitzel Umayz. What did the Jewish people do wrong that they should suffer this terrible bondage amongst the nations? Omar, so he said, Loshen Ara Yesh B'Neim. Right? There's Loshen Ara. They speak negatively. They gossip. Heichem ruim legula. How could they be worthy of redemption? And that's Achein Neida Hadavar. Now I understand the matter. Now I understand that it is in fact through Davar, it's in a sense through their words, that they deserve it. Now I see that there are Dilturim. There are these tattlers who reveal things amongst the Jewish people, and that's why they're in Golos. So they take Achein Noida Adavar not as a narrow statement about Moshe Rabbeinu's act, uh-oh, I'm going to get in trouble for killing the Egyptian yesterday, but Moshe Rabbeinu, who was coming out of the house of Pare and beginning slowly the process of trying to relieve the Jewish people of their suffering. He saved them from the hands of, he saved one Jew from the hands of one Egyptian. And that was, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu emerging, or trying to emerge, as the one who would save the Jewish people from the Mitzrim, from the Egyptians. However, it doesn't go so well. It doesn't continue this way. And Moshe Rabbeinu discovers very soon why. That his act of trying to save actually gets nipped in the bud, it gets found out, and Moshe Rabbeinu is a wanted man, and he can't do those kinds of things anymore. And he now understands why it gets nipped in the bud, why he can't continue to redeem the Jewish people, because of the fact that it was revealed, because they were Bali Lashon Hara, because they were Dilturin. Chazal speak about the idea, and the idea that the intra-Jewish fighting is the worst thing that makes the Jewish people most weak and most vulnerable and most subject to this kind of suffering. Idea being that Gemara demonstrates that in certain periods, even in the days of Achav, the Jewish people triumphed in battle. When there was Shalom Beinim, when there was peace between them, but here there was this difficulty between them, and they emphasized that aspect, that here there was this infighting. Maral does not speak about that aspect at all. According to the Maral, what Maral is seeing here is the specific idea of Achein Noida Hadavar, the fact that it has become known, something which was supposed to be secretive, something which was supposed to be not known. Nobody had any business talking about it. Now it has become known. And according to the Maral, there lies the rub. It's not just the lack of midas, it's not just the lack of shalom, it's the fact that noida hadavar, something which both would be quiet, became numb. And so what's the idea? So the Maral explains as follows. Okay, and I'm reading, those who are interested in following in, it's the second column on page Pehei, and about halfway down of the second column, about three quarters of the way down the page. Vida, there's a period, and then Vida. Kibozer remes mufla v'teido eu. There's a very important hint here. Mufla, an amazing hint that'll play in later, you'll see in a second, so you can know it. V'zeki kasher ayo Moshe Rabbeinu alav asholei mafchin es Yisrael. When Moshe Rabbeinu was trying to study and discern the nature of the Jewish people, why are the Jewish people enslaved? Shouldn't they be free? Why? Why aren't they free? When it became known to them that there were dilturim, that there were these people who revealed secrets, it became known to them that they would deserve shibud. Why? So he says as follows. He says, that which is geshem, that which is physical, is acted upon by other things. That which is tzura, that which is the structure, right, that acts upon. There's always chomer and tzura. And to be subject, to be a shibud, implies a certain being just chaimer, being more, having deeper physicality. So what does that got to do with this thing of achein noida hadavar? So he says, because I already explained to you that gili hasaid, revealing of secrets, is a matter which is gashmi. And the idea is, because physicality is visible, depth is spirituality. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam is Raya Ve'enai Nira. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam sees, but Rabbeinu Shel Olam is invisible. Matters of the spirit is that which are not known so readily, not so visible to the eye. And the more you have to deal only with that which is visible and tangible, the more removed you are from the world of physicality. That's where the difference lies. We've talked about this at different times, and we talked about it last week, right, when we were learning Perek Yud Ches, where the Maral spoke to some degree about this idea. But there's such a thing of, you know, Yoshev B'Seiser Elyon, right? The Rabbeinu Shel Olam has a place which is known as Mistorim, a place which is hidden and secretive. The Rabbeinu Shel Olam is invisible. The spiritual is invisible. Maybe it isn't always supposed to be that way, as we've discussed. Adam HaRishon at one point saw Hashem. When Adam HaRishon ate from the tree of knowledge, what does it say? His eyes opened. His eyes opened to what? Now what was he seeing? Now he saw physicality. He saw the tree as a delicious physical specimen, and he ceased to see the tree as a horrible thing, because after all Hashem said it's a terrible thing. He saw what was external, but he didn't see the internal truth of it. And as the Meshech Chachma points out, so what happens next? Adam HaRishon, who now sees the physical tree, sees his nakedness and the nakedness of his wife, what does he now happen? He hears Hashem traveling through the garden, because now seeing Hashem became less obvious. It became much more of a subtlety. Spirituality became a subtlety, and materialism became, quote unquote, reality, the real world, that which you see. And that's why, as we've explained, at Har Sinai, Chazal described that Chol Bnei Yisrael Royim Es HaKoylois, the Jewish people saw the thunder. What does it mean that they saw the thunder? The thunder, say Chazal, they saw that which was normally heard. And they heard that which was normally seen, which means that their perceptions were again upended, that they became more aware and the internal reality, that which is usually the hidden aspects of the world, became more bolet, became more real to them. Yes, and in a world like that, in fact, spirituality is visible. Spirituality is seen. So the Maharal says, part of being a person of subtlety, a person of internality, is being able to live with something quietly, keeping a secret. You know, when somebody's a blabbermouth, when they can't keep anything to themselves, can you imagine the person as a person of great depth? Usually we can even see how that goes along with a certain externality, a certain superficiality to the person as a whole. So because the person is so driven by superficiality, having a knowledge of something, a piece of information that is only theirs, superficial, has nothing which just stays inside, which is nurtured by anything for themselves. You know, I mentioned once in some very different context that an extremely, extremely surprising thing, shocking thing, but that I think was demanded by the altar of Kelm, if I'm not mistaken. But he said that when a person has something that really strikes them, they shouldn't tell it to anybody. Okay, I'm not. This is not a fresh quote, but it goes something like this.
You shouldn't tell them, or just that they should.
You keep it to yourself, and because you know in Kelm they were very into being real. They were very into emes, into truth, and truth is very, very internal, very, very internal. You know the Kutzker, who was similarly from a different branch, but was similarly, you know, driven and motivated by concern for truth, you know, he pithily said that the person lying on his deathbed, calling out Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, is thinking that at his funeral somebody's going to say, oh, you know, he said Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. You know, just constant awareness of the internal, and in that framework, so that Kelmer thought, you have to nurture, you have to nurse an insight for it to be real to you. It has to be yours and just yours. Once you bring it out, in a certain sense, that is going to be violated, and it's all part of this perception, this perspective of Noida Dover, Dover Shebegoli Hu Shafal Upachis. Something which is out there, it's small, it's lowly. The Gemara says, makes a drasha chamuke yerechech kemoi chaloim, right? That describes the issue of not just teaching Torah in the marketplaces and the billboards. This was a big machlaikas in the world of Kiruv Rechaikim about, you know, how it has to be done. And part of the perspective, maybe, is there was a perspective of some, by Rosenberg's Rechaim Levracha, was, yeah, you know, blasted from the rooftops, from the streets. Tyra is supposed to be something which is beseser. The greatest things, the deepest things, are held in a certain private way, hidden from the public eye. And so when Moshe Rabbeinu looks and he says, you know, this was something which was internal, which was private, which he hid in the sand. Remember what the Maharal said at the end of the Perek? I mentioned somehow in the middle last week of Perek Yud Ches that he buried him in the sand. Sand is something which it's not bigashmius because it doesn't clump together, right? So it remains its own separate things. It doesn't grow in gashmius, and it muffles. Sand muffles. Sand doesn't make noise because it's not so physical, because it doesn't grow big physically, so therefore it doesn't make a lot of noise. Noise is made by gashmias, right? The things which are most audible. That's the general picture which he's trying to draw here, and it's this idea of silence. When he sees the Jewish people not able to keep it to themselves, they should be attached to pnimius, and instead they're not, they're superficial, that's why they're meshubad, because they're closer to Geshem, they're closer to physicality, and once they're closer to physicality, of course, they're closer to be taken over by something else, as opposed to tsura, which is a structure which comes from wisdom and internality, that is less subject to shibud. That's the yisayid which the Maral says. And he goes on to say a fascinating interpretation of words and letters and numbers. And he says, and he says the same thing in the Gur Aryeh, Achein Noida HaDavar. Moshe Rabbeinu uses this unusual word, Achein. Moshe Rabbeinu could have just said, Vayomer Moshe, Noida HaDavar, right? Achein is alas, you know, indeed, Noida HaDavar. So what's the Achein? So he says, Achein, the gematria of Achein is 71. There's Aleph, and then there's Chaf and Nun, which are 70. So he says, this is the Jewish people versus the nations of the world. Remember much earlier in the Gemara Hashem, when he spoke about the Shivim Nefesh, the 70 souls of the Jewish people who went down to Mitzrayim, that it only once the Jewish people became 70 souls, which in some way relates to the 70 nations, that's when they would begin to interact and contrast and struggle with Shibud, with the 70 nations. But when they were just the one Av, the one Avram, the one Yitzchak, the one Yaakov, or even the Echad of the 12, then they wouldn't be able to be subject to it. It's only when somehow we enter the realm of the 70 that we become that way. But it becomes, Mitzrayim is the beginning of the conflict between the Jews and Shibud Malchios, the Jews and the nations. And so it's the one offset by the 70. Achein. And so he says, but it's not just one against 70. It's Aleph against Cain. And he says, Milas Cain einai meira rak al dover yodua umeshur. When you say Cain, you say thus. You know, you can point to it. There's a reality to it. Hilosha in Cain, what's a loymar Cain who? So it is. Vizem meira al dover yodua. That refers to something visible and known. Right? When you say Cain is, yeah, that's right. So there's a certain public factor to that. In contrast to the Aleph is a hidden letter, says the Maral. What do I mean that the Aleph is a hidden letter? So he says, first of all, there's silent Alephs all over the place. Right? Aleph doesn't make a sound. What's the difference between Kuf Resh and Kuf Resh Aleph? Kuf Resh with a kamatz under the resh, right? Kuf Resh without a kamatz, it would be kar, right? But you put a kamatz under the resh, and it could be kara. What's the aleph? The aleph is quote unquote silent. Sometimes, right? You might have, you know, if you have an aleph with a patach at the beginning of the word, right? So then it's not silent, or an aleph with a segel, or whatever it is at the beginning of the word. It's not silent. But Aleph, many times, Vayomer. Right? Va, Vav, Yud, Mem, Resh. No, Vav, Yud, Aleph, Mem, Resh. So he says, Aleph. The letter Aleph. The first letter of the Aleph Beis, which is the Echad letter. Echad is, of course, the Rabbeinu Shalom. When you're just dealing with one, we don't even want to say Rishon first, because first implies part of a series. But when we say Echad, it's one alone. That's the Rabbeinu Shalom. And that same letter, which is one, which doesn't represent Gashmias, because Gashmias is divided, is also a letter which is silent. You see what the Maral is saying? Tamina Aleph Nemel Bekriya. And he says another thing. What's the letter Aleph? How's the letter Aleph itself spelled? Aleph, Lamed, Fe. Right? Like Aleph. Which are the same letters as Pe, Lamed, Aleph. Pella. What's Pella? Something which is Mufla is actually something which is hidden. Right? The term mufla is hidden. We say a miracle is a pella, is a nasal pella. Why? Because it is something which is beyond our normal experience. Right? But the term is, right? Mufla is apart, separate. Rashi says that in Chumash himself someplace. Now we use it sometimes also kiafli is to express, because of the factors of the Hebrew language, is to bring out words which were hidden and then they get brought out. So it's still playing with the same idea. Something which was internal, dibur, is taking that which is internal and bringing it out. That's called being mafli. That's the same thing with apella. But he says again, that's the theme of Aleph, because it's about the internal. It's about that which is not so readily visible. The kach amar Moshe, achein noida adavar. Indeed, the matter is now known. And explains the Maral, ki shivim umais einam b'mala hanelomim. Vein b'madregas kain. The 70 nations are kain. Yeah, that's it. Visible, identifiable. V'yisrael shem negedam ha'alif. Roish yudi v'em pluim v'nelomim. But the Jewish people are the one. And as the one, they should be silent, hidden. The nature of the Jewish people is therefore much more in the world of the internal. But if neither hadavar, but if the Jewish people are now public, then achein neither hadavar. Then the one, the 70, right? The aleph has become part of the chein, has become part of the, yeah, we can see them. We can see them, they're visible, they're superficial, like anybody else. Achein naida hadavar. Achein naida hadavar. And that therefore makes them liable and susceptible to the matters of Shibud. This is a big thing. It's a big thing. When Yaakov Avinu sent his sons down to Mitzrayim, he wanted them to go down to Mitzrayim in a way where they would not be visible. Lama Tisro. They even went down to Mitzrayim because he was worried that their prosperity that stood in contrast to all of the people who were suffering from famine was in itself a form of over-visibility, more than he wanted. Now, it's true. When we speak about that, we usually speak about a different aspect of it, which is that Yaakov Avinu was concerned about the eye of people, the ayin hara, the grudging eye, that Klal Yisrael shouldn't be so visibly prosperous, because then shalti be ayin hara. The ayin hara would be able to, heaven forbid, have some kind of control over them. But there's a deeper context for it, and there's something called being people of internal quality and of subtlety, and that's a davar chashuv ma'id. It's a very, very significant thing. I hate to get on a soapbox, but the value of the Jewish people that we place upon tznius, upon modesty, is about that. That's what it's about. Right? It's not simply about being provocative, sexually. It's not what it's about, purely. It's about privacy. It's about having something that you keep to yourself. When a woman or a man is modest in his interaction with people from the other gender, what are they really doing? What they're really doing is they're not practicing limitations. They're practicing preservation. They're saving this realm of life for one person. Maybe a person that's in their life now, maybe a person that Emirat Hashem, if they're a younger person, a person that's going to be in their life in the future. With that person, they share. They don't practice, so to speak, tznius with their spouse in the conventional, usual sense. Because, for cares, what they're doing with everybody else is to save it, to make it something meaningful for their spouse, which is supposed to be a private relationship. When the Ramah writes in Shulchan Aruch that a husband and wife should not display their affection for each other in a public manner, in a public way. Why? Because this is supposed to be a relationship, and the depths of a relationship lies in the privacy of the relationship. I don't know, you know, the other day I walked into some place and sitting on a bench outside were a man and woman, you know, carrying on. I wasn't so impressed by the love which they must have for each other. If they had a deep love for each other, they probably wouldn't be doing it on a bench in front of a store. There's something called being an internal person, and tznius is an expression of that. And that's why tznius isn't just about what you wear, but tznius is about how you express yourself. Tznius is about, you know, I mean, one of the great assaults on tznius, of course, is the Twitter Facebook phenomenon, where people are constantly updating people about everything that happens in their life. And if it's not out there, and if my 500 friends don't know about it, then it didn't happen. Then it didn't happen. You know that expression which used to be once upon a time, that the machers, you know, if it doesn't make it to the paper, then it didn't happen. Right? That's not the world of internal reality which a human being is supposed to live in. And when the founders of such things declare that we feel that privacy as we know it is a thing of the past, which is the approach of thinking. I mean, I don't remember the founder of which one of these gems does it, but he in his office, he has a bathtub in the plate glass window in the front of his office, and he sits in the bathtub with his clothes on. He sits in the bathtub and works. It's just meshuga. I mean, I'm not making this up. I am not making this up. Okay, I saw a picture. It was in the paper. It was on his Facebook page. But the notion is there is no such thing as internality. There is no such thing as something just for you to keep for yourself. There is no such thing as the altar of Kelm. You don't want to be as extreme as the altar of Kelm. But you understand when you hold on to something for yourself for just a little bit, you have a chance to at least get it to develop within you, to really connect to it. And we're just too afm lung, afm tsung. You know, that's an expression in Yiddish, which is, if it's on the lung, it's on the tongue. It means if you think it, you say it. It's not a compliment. It's not a compliment. To be careful means that, you know, you have a world inside of yourself. There's a Chassidish Shavart that they say that the Gemara, that the Mishnah says in the beginning of I forget already, right this second, but it's a Mishnah in Taras when it speaks about a Beis HaKovod, a house of honor. What's a house of honor? Well, in a certain sense, it's a euphemism. It's a bathroom. Is referred to as a Beis HaKovod. And the Mishnah says, what's with the Beis HaKovod? So it says, if you come there and you find it you find it locked, you know that there's somebody there. So in a certain sense, that's like the Kovod. You know, you're able to get a signal, there's somebody there. So the Chassidim say that if you come to somebody and he's a little bit locked, in other words, not everything, it's not like after you meet them for 15 minutes they're telling you about the struggles that they had as a teenager or in their marriage or whatever else it is, but you know, there's a little bit of a sense of privacy, then you know that there's a person in there. Yadua sheyeshamish. Not, heaven forbid, to say that the value of sharing and seeking to be, you know, to open as necessary. The same Chazal told us, Dagoblev Ishi Sachena, that if a person has a worry in their heart, they should share it. They should share it with somebody else. And of course, having things bottled up and locked up inside when they're difficult is corrosive and negative, and living secret lives, as heaven forbid, is a very, very difficult thing. But we understand what we're talking about. That there's still a realm of feeling, of discernment, of understanding, which the more it's as a sort of private, hidden thing, the more real and strong it is. And so Moshe Rabbeinu was so disturbed. This was the ultimate internal act. And I would just close, you know, the simplest thing when you read this thing of Chenai Da'adava, of Moshe Rabbeinu, to shift gears entirely, but then to show why it's not a complete shift of gears, is that what is more disturbing than a Jew taking another Jew outside, you know, to some, you know, to outside authorities because of something internal. And understand that people, you know, I've heard it in my limited career and exposure to this thing, I've heard it from goyim, from judges, from others, like, don't you want to settle this thing yourself? You know, a brother has a dispute with his sister and they take it to court. You know what that means? That means that there's no family anymore. If you go outside to the court, that means that your family, for all intents and purposes, doesn't exist. So besides halachas of prohibitions against going to arkois and chil Hashem and everything else, but they think, couldn't you guys figure this out for yourselves? Like, what's going on? You would have expected it. You're a community. Work it out. And when the person goes outside, right, here is a Jew defending another Jew from an Egyptian, who would imagine that he would be safe amongst the Jews? It's us. This is us. This is for us. But there's no Jewish people anymore if it goes to the Mitzrayim. That's the simplest Achei Noida Adavar of the Dilturin. Look what's going on. But in a certain sense, of course, that's also part of this. Nurturing a sense of a group for, you know, we're here together, we're for each other. You know, that sense is also part of a real connection is we do amongst ourselves, and we're guarded and aware of the difference between, you know, doing it internally and not doing it internally. This is part of what the Maral teaches here. We'll have to continue with more in Perek Tetzaveh next time.
Sneas doesn't seem to have a word in English. I don't know what other language.
The usual is modesty.